Good morning, Chief Justice, Justice Berger, Vice Chancellor Noble. As we initiate this new start to the term of the year, we'd like to wish the court a happy new year as well. May it please the court, Santino Chakotay, on behalf of the appellant in this case, Byron Stafford. This appeal comes from a stipulated bench trial after a denial from a motion to suppress by the trial judge. Therefore, the lone issue on appeal involves the decision regarding suppression of the evidence. The two issues that we bring before this court with respect to the officer conduct, which we take issue with, is first whether the initial traffic stop had elevated to a level beyond what is necessary to effectuate that traffic stop, and that the extended duration did not sufficiently relate to the initial violation. In this case, it was a stop for illegal window tint, which is a City of Wilmington code violation. The second issue, and there is some overlap, is during the extended duration of the passenger seizure, in this case, whether there was a reasonable, articulable suspicion that the defendant was armed and dangerous. The record reflects that the trial court orally denied the motion. There was not much of a factual finding other than that the detention pursuant to 1902 was lawful, and there was no mention of the pat-down and whether the articulable facts on the record justified the intrusion of a Terry-type frisk in the situation. The stop occurred at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It was still daylight. It was the month of August. There's nothing in the record to indicate that this was a high-crime area as well. So therefore, the car was stopped for simply the window tint violation. Apparently, the windows were tinted on the driver and passenger side doors, and therefore the car was stopped and the driver was asked for his license, and he conceded that his license was suspended. At that point, what we take issue with is that the investigation shifted towards the passenger. And in this court's decisions in Caldwell, and most recently in Holden, a case which we find strikingly similar to what occurred in this case, where the stop is effectuated and then the passengers are immediately taken out of the car and frisked, without the necessity of what Terry tells us, which is that there has to be a reasonable, articulable suspicion that the officers fear for their safety. That seems to be glossed over occasionally from the Terry language, but that's the seminal holding from Terry, is that that's a necessity, as this court recently found in Holden. The testimony is, the officers were quite candid in their testimony. I don't know whether the state disputes any of the testimony. It can be found on page 38 and 39 of the record. We have Officer Santiago's questions as to what led him to believe that the defendant was armed and dangerous. And he could not point to any articulable facts to warrant why officer safety was triggered in this case.
Could I interrupt for a second?
Absolutely. Sure.
Wasn't this a situation where the police were going to have to transport these people to the police station?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. Although there is the testimony touches on that at the beginning of the officer's suppression hearing testimony, I'd like to point the court to the record specifically on page 47 and 48. On cross-examination, trial counsel directed Officer Santiago to read from his police report. And the quoted language, I don't believe it's in our opening brief. However, it's in the appellant's appendix. And the question as asked was, you know, could you please read verbatim from your police report? And what it indicates is that this officer, meaning Officer Santiago, writing in the first person, removed suspect two from the front passenger seat vehicle and advised him that he was being detained until positive identification could be confirmed. This officer conducted a Terry frisk on suspect two for officer safety. So the question then was followed up that it wasn't because you were bringing him back to the station where something could be falling out in the car, question mark. You specifically noted in your report that it was a Terry stop, a Terry search for officer safety. Is that correct? And the officer answered in the affirmative. So that question directly addresses whether they were going to transport. I think the answer is no. There's no indication of that. Also, touching on that point, in closing...
Wait a second. What happened after, I guess after he was patted down, that's when the gun was discovered, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Am I understanding the facts wrong? Wasn't it the idea that there would have to be some delay here because we've got a driver who doesn't have a license and we've got a passenger who we don't even know who he is? So I'm taking you out of the car, and the next step is going to be you're going to sit in the police car until we figure this out. Is that what was going on or not?
I don't think the record is clear enough to assume that. I think what we can extrapolate from the record is that there was an ongoing investigation to find out the identification of the passenger. As to what steps the officer was going to take, the record leaves a lot to inject in the record or to assume regarding the process of the investigation. We do know that the car was essentially seized for the tinted windows, and it's unclear whether the car could even be driven. So what one of the problems that we have, and this goes to the first issue, is whether what purpose was there to identify the passenger in the first place? If the car wasn't going to be driven by the passenger, it seemed like the officer wanted to find out more about the passenger in the DELGIS system. For what reasons, it's unclear. He could have been fishing for information that he didn't have, but it was an ongoing investigation. So I think the important point to take from what the record or the absence in the record is that we don't know whether the defendant was going to be taken to the police station and booked and essentially searched there. We just don't know that. What we know is that we have an unconfirmed suspicion of criminal impersonation, a Class A misdemeanor. How we leap from that reasonable suspicion to the possibility that weapons are involved, that's the elephant in the room, I think. That leap is so grand that I don't know how the state can inject that, and that's the argument that they tried to make in the papers to this court, as I read them, is that because the defendant was, you know, because there was a suspicion of criminal impersonation, he must be a dangerous person. That's a pretty broad stroke of a brush to paint the situation with. And I would argue that's a dangerous slope to essentially engage in or to be found on if that's how the Terry searches are going to be conducted. And I can't stress enough, this court and Holden expressed that very fear and why the Holden decision we feel is probably the best case representative of what guides this case.
There's some suggestion, by way of implication, if not directly, that the reason the passenger was asked to identify himself, and then the police reacted the way they did because of the false identification, is that they were going to allow the passenger, if he had a valid driver's license, to take the car rather than have it towed. Is that rebutted by the suggestion that there's something inherently dangerous about having a car with tinted windows on the highway? Now, what normally happens to a car with tinted, illegally tinted windows?
The record seems to suggest that on certain occasions, as a courtesy, the car may be driven away. However, it was in violation of the code for tinted windows. So another assumption, and again, now we're just going back into, you know, nothing's quite clear on this record. There wasn't much of finding the fact, but to answer the chief's question, they could have also impounded the vehicle. And that's one of the issues here in this case too, is it's unclear why the investigation shifted to the passenger. We have language in State v. Caldwell where we know that the individualized suspicion is, if the car is being stopped for a traffic violation, is on the driver. How it transfers to the passenger in this case, the record is unclear as to that.
Well, isn't it because the driver didn't have a license?
The driver could not produce identification that pulled up in the Delta system, but that could easily just be assumed that he doesn't have a driver's license. He was a passenger in the vehicle.
No, I'm talking about the driver.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, they stop the car.
Sure.
The driver turns out to have a suspended license, right?
That's correct.
So now they've got something more than what they started with. They've got somebody who's not entitled to be driving and is committing
right.
a violation by doing that, right?
That's right.
Okay, so when you say why does the attention shift to the passenger, isn't it reasonable to assume that that's because we've got a driver who's not authorized to be driving, let's find out who this passenger is and see whether he can drive?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the reasonable suspicion for the traffic stop is whether the driver committed a traffic violation. As to what the passenger is engaged in, again, there needs to be reasonable, articulable suspicion to seize and or pat down the passenger. They are not one and the same. I think what the Fourth Amendment case law tells us is that it's an individualized suspicion. So if there was suspicion that somebody was driving illegally, then certainly they can seize that individual and continue the investigation. In this case, it shifted to the passenger. Again, maybe under the assumption that they were going to allow him to drive or at some point, but again, those are just assumptions. But more importantly, what the record is completely devoid of is any reasonable, articulable suspicion that this passenger is armed and dangerous. And that is a necessity under Terry v. Ohio and its progeny up until most recently this court's decision in Holding that is necessary.
Well, if the police were going, let's take that as sort of a second line of attack. The first is based on whether they should have said anything to the passenger at all or not. And as far as some people might conclude, you would be suggesting to us we write an opinion that results in a holding that says to the police doing a routine traffic stop that when the driver is, for any reason, unqualified to continue to drive, there's only one alternative, and that is impound and tow the car. Even if there are three passengers in the car, all of whom may have a valid driver's license and could drive the car away. That seems a bit silly to me, quite frankly. Common sense says the next step is to find make a decision, are we going to impound this car, tow it away, or are we going to let a qualified driver drive it away? Is there something so inherently dangerous about tinted windows, we can't afford to have this half-ton monster on the street because it endangers the lives of other people or some nonsense like that? It seems perfectly logical, doesn't it, for them to ask the passenger for identification to determine if they can drive the car?
I would agree, Chief, that it would be silly if the car cannot, if the car can be driven away, whether that's something that they can engage in. I think the argument in this case is that legally it's unclear whether the car can be driven, even with the tinted windows. It wasn't violation, although it's not inherently dangerous, it wasn't violation of city code. I think.
All right, what by way of example would have occurred if the reason for pulling the car over was an expired license plate? And the police determined there was a passer in the car. What typically happens if you have an expired registration? Are you allowed to drive the car in order to correct your failure to re-register on time? Or is the car impounded into you until you get your registration updated? What's
the former.
A sensible thing to happen there?
Sure. I think the former is. And
why
of course,
is this different?
Again, the record leaves some assumptions. There's some discussion about impounding the car in the record by the officers that was an option occasionally as a courtesy. They said occasionally, it's not always as a courtesy to let them drive away. But, and again, not to deflect the court's attention, but we concede, even if this court finds that the passenger could be engaged in a 1902 detention, we have a significant problem with the Terry pat-down search.
I understand, and I, in my own mind, obviously not speaking for anyone else, but in my own mind, there's a second argument, and that is whether or not the failure to properly identify oneself to the police officer gives the police officer, in effect, license to pat them down and determine whether or not they're armed before they're taken into custody, even if they would be taken into custody for something like criminal impersonation.
That's exactly right, Chief. And we know it's an objective test, but we know that in order to make an objective analysis, we review the testimony, whether it be subjective of the officers concerned at the time of the stop. And on this record, we would suggest that it was very clear officer safety was not on the minds of Officer Santiago when he decided to handcuff Mr. Stafford and pat him down.
What did he say his reason was?
His reason was that he gives a fake name. That means he's hiding something. I don't know what it is, so that is why we do the search for officer safety. That's on the appendix, page 21. He's hiding what there is an unconfirmed suspicion of criminal impersonation. How we go from there to fear of having a weapon is unclear. I see that I've gone into my rebuttal time.
All right. We'll save the balance of your time.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Berger, Vice Chancellor Noble, good morning. Paul Wallace on behalf of the State. I think to answer a couple of the Court's questions and to answer one of the main arguments by Mr. Cicotti, that this case is just like Holden. It's really quite different than Holden, and the Court has discussed that a little bit, especially with Justice Berger, into how this unfolded. We had what all agree is a valid traffic stop for tinted windows. They go to the driver, and the driver does not have a license. In fact, he's asked about his license. And they run it. It is, in fact, suspended. So they must determine what they must do. And in fact, they make it clear, Officer Santiago makes it clear in the record, that the driver first says that he has no license before he does anything with the passenger or speaks to him at all. That is at A35, when he then says, how about you, basically? Do you have a license? Who are you? He has no identification, no hard identification on him, gives them a name and a date of birth and an address that he goes and runs.
Did he actually ask the question, do you have a license, or did he just ask for identification?
I don't recall how specifically he had asked the question. I believe he asked him for identification. I do recall the exchange between the prosecutor and me.
Yes, because you just said, he said, do you have a license? I want to know whether the record documents that he said that.
I'd have to double check
A35 of the transcript or my reference point.
And I had looked at A35, Your Honor. I believe that that was, I do recall that he was asked, did he have any identification on him? And he said, no, not even a state identification. I do not recall whether or not he specifically asked about, whether he said it in so many words, do you have a driver's license?
The reason I ask, and maybe it's not determinative of the what I consider to be the first issue, but I'm trying to get a feel for what is the typical protocol in this situation. Are the officers trying to figure out whether to impound a car or allow someone to drive it away and correct whatever deficiency there is on the, in this case, illegally tinted windows? It could be anything. It could be expired tags or broken windshield wipers, whatever it may be.
And I believe where we get that, Your Honor, is A19, where he says, he speaks of the courtesy of, look, when we've got somebody suspended, then we try and we may, as a courtesy, say, look, is there somebody else here who can drive? And that's what it appears he was checking into. Things unfolded quickly. He did not have any hard identification on him, gave him information. He went back and ran it. None of it came through in the DELGA system. And then he said, my next step was, he had not even taken him out of the car at that point. He's going to take him out of the car, and he says, at 8:45:46, he was going to be detained. I was going to transport him to the police station to make a positive identification. I believe I heard my counsel say that, in fact, they don't dispute that this would have been a proper 1902 detention. The question is, what do you do for those 2 hours in a 1902 detention? Does he have to sit there on the roadside and try and sort out somebody who's already told him certain information? No, certainly he can take him to detention.
Are you arguing this is a search incident to detention?
I am arguing that it is a reasonable search in a 1902 type detention where he's asked for identification and not gotten anything valid at that point.
That dispenses with the requirement that there be an articulable suspicion that he's armed and dangerous?
Under the circumstance where that detention is going to be transporting him, I would suggest the question is the reasonableness of patting someone down before they in fact transport them. He makes it very clear that he is going to take him to the police station to sort this out and to try and positively identify who he is.
Well, he already knows at that point that he's violated the law because he had given a false identification, right? Correct?
I mean, he had probable cause.
He could have been arrested then for criminal impersonation.
He could have, and then he could have just done the search incident to arrest. What I'd suggest is these police officers are being very reasonable in what they do. They try to take it step by step. They're not simply there to grab up these two guys and pull them up, you know, pull them in. They make the stop. The driver doesn't have a license, so he asks him for his information. If he was going to be unreasonable, he would have taken him right out and you know, rousted him, said, who are you? What are you doing? He doesn't. They take it step by step, and each step, I'd suggest, is reasonable, which is really the barometer of the Fourth Amendment, and if we go to the Delaware Constitution, the same.
Is the record clear that the next step, as you say, was going to be, I'm going to take him to the station so that we can figure out who he is? I mean, is that somewhere in the record?
Yes. At 8:45:46, Your Honor, this was his quote, Officer Santiago's quote. He was going to be detained. I was going to transport him to the police station and make positive identification. And before he gets in my vehicle, before I have more contact with him, I want to search and make sure he's safe before I put him in my vehicle.
And I may be getting mixed up with other cases, but I believe that there is some testimony, again, it may not be this case, that that's pretty much what always happens, that the police are not about to put anybody into one of their patrol cars without first patting them down.
Officer Santiago certainly says that in so many words in this. I think that statement itself says it, but he says, look, I've got to check for my safety and his safety. I'm not just going to put him in a car. He does say that elsewhere. I cannot give the court the page right now because they go back to it a couple times. I think it's A49 because that's another place he talks about the transport and the search part.
Okay, so what I'm trying to get at is that from the defense's side, this was unreasonable because, after all, there was absolutely no basis to suspect that this person was armed and dangerous in terms of what had transpired prior to the pat-down. And if I understand correctly from the state's perspective, it's not a question of whether anything he had done prior to that time made him someone who might be armed and dangerous. It was the fact that because of what had transpired, he was now going to have to be taken in a patrol car, and that creates a different circumstance where, as a matter of officer safety, you pat them down. It doesn't matter who they are, you pat them down before you let them into the car.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. That the state would suggest is really the first part of our argument. The second part of our argument is he actually had probable cause to fully arrest him anyway. And so that would have entailed the pat down and putting him in the car. Based on that, if you needed something more than this was a reasonable step in the 1902 detention of transporting him to further determine his identity at the police station.
Are you saying the officer at that point had determined to arrest him?
I'm not saying that at all, Your Honor.
I'm stringing from the transcript, and there was no crime that you believe that he had committed at that point. And the officer goes on to say, correct, I'm at page A36, yes. A37 of the transcript, of the appendix, rather. In other words, there had been no intent to make an arrest. There had been some undifferentiated intention to make a detention. And what I'm worried about is you're projecting a black line rule that if there's going to be a detention and they're going to go anyplace else, that gives the police the right to conduct a pat down.
First, Your Honor, I want to go to the record for a moment because that's one part of the record. At A45, however, the police officer specifically says, look, at this point, I realize I have criminal impersonation. Now, again, I think he's being reasonable. What he's trying to determine is, what do I do with this guy? Do I arrest him for criminal impersonation? Do I just further identify him and maybe for some reason he just doesn't want to give me his name that's really doesn't make much sense? There's several decisions that they're trying to make out there. What do I do with the car? What do I do with the driver? What do I do with this guy? So I think he did recognize that, in fact, there was criminal impersonation and that he was investigating that. He just hadn't made the final decision, am I going to fully, formally arrest him? To get to the court's second question, I would suggest that as part of a 1902 detention, that when police officers have reasonable, articulable suspicion and that they are going to transport somebody, that yes, that it is reasonable to pat them down just to ensure they have nothing that can harm them, and that's all he was doing.
Reasonable, articulable suspicion of what?
Well, in this case, certainly criminal impersonation at very least.
But not necessarily that there's any personal risk or that the person's armed and dangerous.
No. If you look at the statute, 1902 is followed by 1903, and what 1903 says is, whenever the officer has reasonable ground to believe the officer in danger if the person possesses a dangerous weapon. Well, certainly, if part of the detention is going to be, I'm going to put you in the back of my car and we have to go down to the police station because, and he said one of the things he talks about in further identifying and determining whether this is a true criminal impersonation and whether or not he's going to arrest him for it is to check fingerprints, to check NCIC, things like that. If he's going to put him in the back of the car, certainly it is reasonable for a reasonable ground to believe that the officer is in danger if the person possesses a weapon. If I put him in the back of my car and he has a weapon, in this case, the gentleman had a gun, the police officer is wholly vulnerable. There's nothing that he can really do about that. So The state suggests that that minimal intrusion of a pat-down before you continue on with a detention, because you're going to take them somewhere else, you're going to put yourself at risk, is what 1903 speaks to, and I'd suggest the reasonableness standard of the Fourth Amendment.
So in other words, if there's a detention under 1902 and the person is going to be moved someplace, that authorizes a pat-down?
I would suggest if it's going to be moved in a way that might put this officer in danger, yes. I think that's what 1903 speaks to.
Do we also have an issue here? I don't know that it's fully set forth, but I got that impression that when the officer determined that he had been given false information about the identity of this person, the concern became that somebody who's going to lie about who he is somebody who's probably got some problem that the police would be interested in knowing about if they knew who he really was, and that adds to the level of concern about safety.
I think that certainly adds the fear, a little more of a fear factor for the police officer. This is somebody I'm dealing with who doesn't want to tell me who he is. I don't know I'm not going to say that just because somebody says, you know, absent everything else, let's say the driver did have a valid license and could have driven away, and the police officer just sees the guy in the car and said, hey, who are you? Which, by the way, this court, the Chief Justice mentioned writing a new opinion. You would be unwriting Loper, for instance, which was decided in 2010, which this court specifically said it's perfectly permissible in the United States Supreme Court to ask for identifying information from passengers no matter what the circumstance. But let's say we had that circumstance and he said, who are you, and he gives bad information. It is not the state's position that he could just yank him out of the car and pat him down and everything else. That's not the circumstance here. And we would suggest simply giving the police officer false information in that kind of context where he doesn't have to worry about other things wouldn't justify a pat-down. It's very different, though. And the difference is they've got to decide what to do with these gentlemen. And part of the problem is he's going to take him in at this point based on the potential of criminal impersonation. Because the police officer might say, all right, this passenger doesn't want to tell me who he is. That's criminal impersonation. I can use my discretion to further investigate or not. What do I do in this circumstance? And there are many discretionary calls in this factual circumstance that they had to make, and I'd suggest that if we look at each one, in each circumstance, they are taking kind of the lesser approach first in leaving them in the car, looking to see who they may be, looking to see if their driver, you know, the passenger is an option to take the car away. Certainly that's one option that I've certainly seen in all kinds of equipment violations, and that is you write them up for the tinted windows and the suspended passenger, you take the car. Buddy, you better get the window tinting off or you're going to continue to get stopped. And here's your $300 fine or whatever it is for that.
Is there a way of deciding this case without reaching the issue of the scope of the police authority to search when they've determined that someone who's simply detained as opposed to someone who's arrested is being placed in a vehicle for the purpose of transporting them to the police station?
Well, perhaps the cleanest line to that, Your Honor, is the fact that he had probable cause, and therefore it would have been a search to his interest.
That's what I was getting at, actually. Is the law still that it doesn't matter whether the police officer believed he had probable cause to arrest or not? The question is, was there objectively probable cause for an arrest?
From the state's position, absolutely, Your Honor. It's an objective test. Objectively, is there probable cause to believe that this person has committed an offense? Because otherwise, they get the benefit of a police officer who misconstrues.
Before the pat-down, on the facts of this case, is there probable cause to believe that the passenger in the car, the defendant here, was criminally impersonating another?
Yes, I suggest there is. That he had committed criminal impersonation, he committed an act identifying himself during a police investigation or traffic investigation in that assumed character. And that itself would have allowed
much more activity. So the police officer could have legitimately said, you're under arrest for criminal impersonation, handcuffed him, pat him down because he's going to transport him in the car, and that's police protocol, and as you put it, it's reasonable under the circumstances anyway. takes him back to the police station, reruns the computer and finds out, oh no, he is who he says he is, or he does have a valid identification and he was just jerking me around. Police officer could say, well, I'm not going to formally do the paperwork necessary to arrest you.
He could.
Basically undo the arrest.
He could. I mean, if upon further investigation, the police officer determined in his discretion, I'm not going to bring that charge, you know, you were a scared kid or you were whatever, and that's why you said you were
scared. Can we get down to the basic point that I understand the defense making, which is probable cause to arrest for anything doesn't mean you have a reasonable articulable suspicion that somebody needs to be patted down for your safety or that they may be armed, and that there's nothing about probable cause to arrest for criminal impersonation that suggests that there's a license on the part of the police to pat someone down even before they put them in the vehicle.
I think the defense doesn't even get to the there's probable cause for criminal impersonation, but although they do seem to want to add that layer that even if there is probable cause, you also need some separate belief that they're armed and dangerous.
I don't want to improperly structure their argument. It just seems to me there either is or isn't probable cause to arrest for criminal impersonation. So the issue is, what is the line that needs to be drawn, if it's not drawn by precedent, about the extent to which there can be a legitimate pat down for the officer's safety when the crime itself doesn't inherently suggest that the defendant may be armed?
Your Honor, I think that there is a line of cases, and the court wouldn't be drawing new case law, that says officer safety is an exigency. And in these particular circumstances where a police officer has determined that he's going to have to transport somebody, that exigency of officer safety would permit that minimal intrusion of a pat-down before he puts him in the car to take him away from the scene. 1902 permits that two-hour detention, and therefore there has to be at least the reasonable exercise of ensuring officer safety during that 2 hours, and specifically in a dangerous circumstance like putting a person behind you who has already lied to you about who he is before you do that. There are no other questions from the court.
Thank you.
I have nothing further. Thank you.
There seems to be a lot of discussion regarding whether there was probable cause to arrest Mr. Stafford. The record is pretty clear on that point. Officer Santiago testified that he did not know that Mr. Stafford's name, birth date, and Delaware address were false at the time that he frisked him and handcuffed him. He was investigating whether the name was going to turn up. The only place he checked was the Delta system. He had not checked the National Registry. It's easily as plausible to assume that... I think what's lost here is they didn't go up to the passenger and the passenger refused to answer any questions. He gave them a name that ended up being false. Sure. But you have to investigate that information to determine whether he actually met all the elements for criminal impersonation. At the time of the frisk and the when he handcuffed him, he did not, he admits, I mean, the testimony is rather forthcoming in this case, that he did not know that the crime had occurred yet. He was still investigating the crime. Hence, he wanted to check out the name. I see my time has expired.
Well, but whether your time's expired or not, I'd like you to finish that point, because that's where I'm focused, at least, and that is whether or not there was reason to believe that the passenger in the car had given false identification at the point that he was handcuffed and patted down, because the police officer had determined that he was going to transport him by vehicle back to the police station.
And Chief, we also...
He checked one set of records that suggested that the name and address were false.
Correct. the Delta system.
Then he handcuffed him and patted him down, and his response, if I were asking questions today, might be, well, my investigation was incomplete at that point. I hadn't yet determined whether I would arrest him or not, but I was going to check it out further. Something along those lines is what he said, right?
That's correct.
But does that equate to, I didn't have reason to believe that he had committed an offense at the time I handcuffed him and patted him down?
At that point, it's simply an unconfirmed suspicion that he gave him false identification. He admits that he couldn't confirm it. Has he confirmed that the name was inaccurate, then he could arrest for criminal impersonation at that moment. But he admits that he couldn't do that then. In fact, he's asked, did you arrest him for any crime? He says no.
Yeah, well, that's the point. And I give you the same opportunity that the prosecution had to answer. Is the law that he had to have conclusive evidence of guilt of criminal impersonation at that point in order to have probable cause to arrest him? And did the officer have to believe that he had probable cause? Or is the question, were there sufficient facts objectively apparent at the time he handcuffed him and patted him down that there was reason to believe that the crime of criminal impersonation had been committed?
I think it's fair to say it's an objective test from our case law. We know it's an objective test. And here, I think the furthest we can go, extrapolating from the record, based on the testimony from the officers and from what's missing. I think that has to be said. There's a lot missing on this record. And the court unfortunately didn't help matters by not having too much of a finding of fact, which I know sometimes is difficult for this court to review if there's not much there. But based on that, we're only at the level of reasonable suspicion that criminal impersonation is going on. If it was probable cause, then he can arrest him. We know that from the case law. And he did not have that. And I think, if I could just add one more point, there seems to be, I know the state has plans to the record where Officer Santiago indicates that he's definitely going to transport him to the station. It's interesting that his own police report doesn't include that. And I would add that in closing, at arguments at the suppression hearing, the state failed to make that argument as well, that he was going to be transported.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.